The sea does not announce itself. It moves first. Wind presses from the east. Water pulls west. Long before borders, before flags, before names for the islands, those forces were already deciding who could arrive, who could leave, and who would be trapped in between. Canoes learned the rules early. Ships learned them later. People paid the price every time the rules were ignored. The Caribbean was never isolated. It was exposed, opened by currents that refused to change for human plans. Trade, belief, language, labor, and loss all followed the same invisible lanes. Some islands became crossroads, others became waiting rooms. None were untouched. What looks like culture is often movement slowed down. What feels like history is pressure repeated until it leaves a mark. This is not a story about the sea as backdrop. It is about the sea as architect, shaping lives long before anyone understood the design. Chapter 1. Wind at the back, water below. The sea did not open gently. It moved with intent, steady and relentless. Long before compasses or charts, before flags or empires, the Caribbean was already arranged by forces that could not be negotiated with. Wind pressed from the east, water flowed west. Together, they formed a moving corridor that rewarded those who learned its rhythm and punished those who did not. Indigenous peoples of the Caribbean did not stumble into this system. They studied it. They watched the clouds and the surface of the water. They learned when the wind held firm and when it faltered. Dugout canoes were built low and long, shaped to ride swell rather than fight it. Journeys were planned around seasons, not desire. You moved when the sea allowed it. Travel between islands followed invisible highways. The Lesser Antilles formed a natural stepping path, each island close enough to the next that a skilled crew could cross with confidence. Currents carried canoes forward even when paddles rested. Trade moved this way. Food crops, stone tools, marriage ties, stories. The sea connected communities while keeping others apart. Some islands sat directly in the flow, others lay just outside it. Those differences mattered. Islands aligned with the dominant winds became meeting points. Ideas pooled, dialects blended, practices spread. Islands that sat off the main current lines developed more slowly, more inwardly. Distance was not measured in miles, it was measured in resistance. Navigation demanded precision. Misjudge the wind, and you could be carried far past your target. Fight the current, and exhaustion followed quickly. There was no heroism in stubbornness. Survival depended on reading the sea correctly and respecting its limits. Knowledge passed down through practice, not theory. Elders taught routes by memory, by feel, by repetition. When Europeans arrived, they entered a system already in motion. Their ships were larger. Their intentions were different, but their dependence on wind and water was the same. The Atlantic crossing was not random. It followed a broad arc shaped by the same trade winds indigenous sailors had learned to trust. Sailors dropped south to catch steady easterlies, then rowed them west toward land they did not yet fully understand. The first landfalls were not accidents. Ships emerged where the currents delivered them. Eastern islands bore the earliest contact because they stood directly in the path of arriving vessels. These islands became gateways. Ports formed quickly, sometimes violently. Others, shielded by geography or positioned outside the main flow, remained untouched longer. Delay did not mean safety. It meant postponement. European captains learned fast. They recorded routes. They named winds. They built maps that traced what nature had already drawn. Colonization followed the easiest paths first. Control began where access was simplest. The sea decided which islands would feel pressure early and which would be spared temporarily. Wind-shaped behavior. Ships arriving under full sail needed safe anchorage. Natural harbors became prizes. Islands with deep bays and reliable shelter gained strategic importance. Those without were passed by or used briefly, then abandoned. Geography dictated value long before any governor arrived. Early encounters were unstable. Indigenous communities understood the waters better than the newcomers. They knew escape routes. They knew when storms would break. Europeans relied on size and force, but those advantages weakened quickly when wind shifted or currents tightened. The sea remained neutral. It favored no flag. Settlement patterns followed predictability. Colonies took root where ships could return reliably. A place that could be reached once but not revisited was useless to empire. Winds that allowed outbound travel mattered as much as those that brought ships in. Roots home were as critical as roots of arrival. Some early settlements failed for this reason alone. Crops could grow, land could be cleared. But if supply ships could not reach port consistently, the colony starved. The wind decided which experiments survived and which disappeared. Indigenous displacement began unevenly. Communities on major routes faced sustained intrusion. Others watched from afar, aware something had shifted but not yet pressed directly. The sea created a staggered timeline of contact. History did not arrive everywhere at once. This stagger shaped cultural survival. Languages persisted longer in isolated zones. Practices endured where access was difficult. Where ships returned repeatedly, disruption compounded quickly. The wind did not care what it carried. It moved people and consequences with the same indifference. European narratives later framed discovery as intention. In reality, it was alignment. Ships went where they could go. Power followed paths of least resistance. What looked like planning was often submission to natural constraint. The Caribbean became legible to empire because it was legible to the wind. Routes hardened into expectation. Sailors learned that deviation carried cost. Repetition created confidence. Confidence created control. By the end of the first century of contact, movement patterns had stabilized. The sea lanes were known. The favored islands were claimed. The rest waited. Not safely, just longer. The wind still pressed from the east. The water still moved west. What had changed was who rode those forces and to what end. If nature dictated the routes, control belonged to those who learned fastest how to exploit them. The sea offered no protection, only rules. Those rules were about to be used to move far more than canoes and trade goods. Chapter 2. Routes of profit, routes of people. Once the routes were known, they hardened. Wind and water stopped being obstacles and became instruments. The same forces that had guided canoes and first landfalls were now folded into a system built for scale. Sail did not replace the wind, it surrendered to it. Empires learned quickly that success in the Caribbean meant obedience to the same rules the sea had always enforced. The trade winds ran steady and predictable, east to west across the Atlantic. They pulled ships from European ports toward the Caribbean with speed and consistency. Return routes curved north, catching different currents that carried vessels back across open water. This looping movement became the backbone of Atlantic commerce. It was efficient, it was repeatable, it was devastating. Ports that sat directly along these wind-driven lanes grew fast. Harbors widened, docks multiplied, warehouses followed. Islands positioned slightly off route lagged behind, regardless of soil or labor potential. Geography selected winners before any ledger was opened. Profit depended on rhythm. Ships arrived in seasons, not randomly. Sugar harvests aligned with sailing windows. Miss the wind and cargo spoiled. Miss the tide and ships grounded. Timing became law. Plantation schedules bent to maritime reality, not the other way around. Human beings were folded into this timing with brutal efficiency. The same winds that carried finished goods outward carried captives inward. Ships did not wander. They followed locked paths from African coasts to Caribbean ports, chosen for access, not mercy. Forced migration followed the geometry of wind and current. People arrived where ships could unload safely and quickly. That fact alone shaped demographic concentration. Certain islands received wave after wave of displaced Africans because they sat directly in the corridor. Others saw fewer arrivals, not by design, but by location. Culture moved with bodies. Languages traveled compressed in shipholds. Beliefs survived in fragments. Music rhythms carried memory when words failed. Food practices adapted to what could grow near ports and plantations. Nothing arrived intact. Everything arrived under pressure. Ports became points of collision. African traditions met European control structures and indigenous survival strategies in spaces defined by wind access and anchorage depth. These were not neutral meeting grounds. They were choke points where power could be enforced because movement was constrained. Control was easiest where ships returned often. Repetition allowed oversight. It allowed punishment. It allowed extraction to be scaled. Islands on the main routes felt this pressure relentlessly. Resistance was answered by reinforcement arriving on the same predictable winds. Economic routes hardened into cultural corridors. Music styles clustered where people were clustered. Dialects formed along shipping lines. Religious practices blended differently depending on which African regions fed which ports. These patterns were not random. They were mapped by the sea. The triangular system was never truly triangular on the ground. It bent and warped around weather. Storms delayed arrivals. Hurricanes wiped fleets from memory. But even disaster reinforced the same truth. After every loss, ships returned to the same lanes. Reconstruction followed the same logic as destruction. The sea did not create exploitation. It enabled its scale. Without predictable winds, the system would have fractured under its own weight. With them, it expanded beyond individual cruelty into industrial routine. People moved against their will, but not without agency. Resistance traveled too. Knowledge spread port to port. News of uprisings moved along the same maritime paths as cargo. Techniques of survival and rebellion migrated quietly, stitched together by forced proximity and shared roots. The wind carried rumors faster than authorities liked to admit. Control relied on isolation, but the sea undermined it. Sailors talked. Dock workers listened. Messages slipped through. Still, choice remained limited. Movement followed rotes, not desires. Escape attempts were shaped by geography. Some islands offered refuge because currents could carry small boats away from major lanes. Others trapped those who tried to flee, pushing them back toward controlled shores. Economic centrality created vulnerability. The busiest ports were also the most surveilled. Power concentrated there because access demanded it. Smaller, less connected islands offered fewer opportunities, but sometimes more space to breathe. Over time, cultural identities hardened around these realities. What it meant to belong to a particular island was shaped by who arrived there, when, and under what conditions. The wind decided mixtures long before people named them. European powers fought over these routes because they understood their value. Naval battles were not just about territory. They were about access to predictable movement. Whoever controlled the lanes controlled the flow of wealth and bodies. Yet even at the height of control, the system remained fragile. A shift in weather could disrupt months of planning. A damaged harbor could stall an entire season. The same forces that enabled dominance could erase it without warning. The Caribbean lived under this tension daily. Prosperity and catastrophe arrived on the same winds. The sea fed the system and threatened it at the same time. By the late sail age, the routes were so ingrained they felt inevitable. Generations were born into patterns established before their ancestors arrived. Culture carried the memory of movement even when movement slowed. The sea had done its work. It had fixed paths into habit. Those habits would outlive the ships that created them. The question was no longer who controlled the wind-driven routes. It was whether the region could ever step outside them. Chapter 3. After the sail age, the wind did not stop when engines arrived. It simply lost its monopoly. Steam fractured the old certainty. Ships no longer waited for seasonal permission. They pushed forward against current and weather, burning fuel instead of time. Schedules tightened, routes multiplied. The sea was no longer a single corridor, but a grid. On paper, this looked like freedom. In practice, the old paths held. Ports built for sail did not disappear. They adapted. Harbors widened, docks deepened. The same islands that had dominated wind-driven trade became hubs of mechanical movement. Infrastructure followed history. Investment followed infrastructure. Geography still decided winners. The decline of sail did not erase cultural patterns created under it. Movement slowed, but memory did not. Migration continued along familiar lines. People left islands the same way goods once had, north, along routes already tested by centuries of passage. Cities abroad grew Caribbean neighborhoods that mirrored old port relationships. Language patterns followed shipping records long forgotten. Foodways traveled intact this time, carried by people who chose to move rather than being forced. But the direction was familiar. The sea had written the map long before planes took over. Coastal life in the Caribbean remained shaped by water. Fishing grounds followed currents. Storm paths determined building styles. Knowledge of wind still mattered, even if fewer people sailed by it. Hurricanes arrived with the same logic they always had, tracing heat and flow without regard for borders. Disaster exposed continuity. When storms struck, aid arrived along the same routes commerce once did. Islands best connected recovered faster. Isolation still carried cost. the sea continued to reward access and punish distance. Cultural resilience grew from this awareness. Music spoke of movement and return. Stories held the memory of departure, even when told inland. Identity in the Caribbean remained tied to water, not as romance, but as fact. Climate change introduced a new pressure. Currents warmed, storms intensified, predictability weakened. The old rules still applied, but with sharper consequences. Communities built under stable patterns now faced instability layered on top of inherited vulnerability. The question of adaptation resurfaced, heavier than before. A region shaped by fixed natural forces now faced shifting ones. Ports built for one era strained under new demands. Coastlines eroded. Fishing yields changed. The sea was still in control, but the terms were different. Yet the past offered instruction. Caribbean history was a record of adjustment under pressure. People had learned to read the sea once. They would have to learn again. The sail age ended. The routes remained. Culture carried their imprint forward. The wind no longer decided everything, but it had already decided enough.